Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you from People's Dispatch. Now, it turns out, of course, one of the People's Dispatchers is right beside me. That's Zoe. Prashant is over there on the screen with you. That's Prashant and Zoe from People's Dispatch, peoplesdispatch.org. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Really happy to be back. I know it's been spotty. We've all been on the road trying to report the important stories of our time for you. But here we are. Now, the most important news right now on Thursday. Of course, it's obvious that if aid trucks entered Gaza, it would have been obvious and clear that people in near famine conditions near the Rafah border, very clear, would have rushed at them. For weeks, there has been inadequate food provision, humanitarian convoys not able to enter the Gaza Strip, UNRWA, the UN agency, unable to provide material support to the people. In fact, the situation so grave that the Norwegian Refugee Council had said repeatedly, using phrases like famine conditions, UN special rapporteurs talking about famine conditions and so on. On Thursday, 38 aid trucks entered Gaza. It was pretty clear that people were going to rush at the trucks. I have never been in a situation where aid trucks entered a refugee camp or a place where really desperate people are around, where people don't rush at the trucks. In fact, most aid officials are highly skilled, trained to deal with that situation. This is not an uncommon situation, in fact, a deeply common situation. So, on Thursday, 38 trucks enter the Gaza Strip, people rush at the trucks. Israeli forces claiming that they felt under attack or under threat from unarmed civilians, desperate for food, desperate for water, desperate for basic supplies. Remember, these are unarmed civilians who came up to the trucks with that energy of desperation that marks people who are in near famine conditions. At that point, Israeli troops opened fire on the Palestinians, killing over 100 people. Now, this is one incident. It's being called the Bread Massacre. It's one incident of a major killing of a large number of people, 100 people just killed in a matter of an hour. It's interesting. Widespread condemnation has come around the world of this Bread Massacre. The Gaza Health Ministry, of course, released statements saying somewhere between 100 and 100 people have been identified as killed. I'm sure the numbers might rise. Doesn't matter. 100 people is a lot of people to be killed in one incident like this, adding to the overall total of over 30,000 Palestinians killed in this particular war that Israel has been conducting against the people of Gaza, the Palestinians of Gaza. Now, the United States government reacted along the grain of the Israeli government. United States government said that we will study the two versions. There is, in fact, footage shot by Israeli drones of this incident. And when you look at the footage, it's pretty clear, and the footage has been widely circulated, it's pretty clear that there were people moving towards the aid truck and then the people started to fall. There is no ambiguity here. There is no multiple firing because these were unarmed people. So, for a government like the United States has a veto power in the UN Security Council, for a government like that to make such a outrageously misleading statement, as we'll be studying the two versions, shows us in a sense how little concern there is for the humanity of the Palestinians, shows us also the kind of disregard held by high officials of the US government that they would make such a not only callous statement, but in fact, a misleading statement, as I said already. This will be investigated. There's no doubt about that. There has to be an investigation. Israeli troops, active troops in the middle of a conflict, massacre 100 people, maybe more than 100 people. There will be an investigation of this. Now, whether this investigation leads to, this is the important point, individual culpability of the troops that opened fire is the question. Because in a war zone, generally one doesn't attribute individual culpability. But this is a massacre of civilians. And I think it'll be seen in the International Court of Justice and other places whether there will be individual, there'll be complaints made against these very troops. Maybe there'll be some war crimes kind of allegations. Prashant, there's already heated up discussion at the International Criminal Court. Fascinating debates and disputes. I don't think, Prashant, the world has heard from the International Criminal Court with as much enthusiasm or at least attention as over the past several months. I mean, many people didn't even know the International Court of Justice existed, Prashant. What's been happening recently in the International Court of Justice over the past several weeks?
Right. We do know about the very important hearings that took place at the International Court of Justice earlier this year when South Africa moved a petition against Israel asking for the ICJ to immediately stop, accusing Israel of genocidal acts, asking the International Court of Justice to issue provisional measures to stop any of these acts which might cause genocide. Very, very powerful arguments made by South Africa's legal team. Arguments, I think, that went around the world. You mentioned very aptly that I don't think in recent times anybody has, paid so much attention to the ICJ, and these arguments went across the world in the form of, all these very, very powerful arguments. And the ICJ did deliver a verdict. Of course, it's been over a month since that verdict was delivered, and we've seen no action on the part of Israel, although Israel was asked to ensure that, no genocide takes place. It was asked to ensure increased humanitarian aid. And we saw what happened yesterday when it comes to humanitarian aid. But what we're talking about this week is a completely different case, which is, in 2022, towards the end of 2022, the United Nations General Assembly asked the International Court of Justice to provide a legal opinion on the consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. Now, it's the parts of the West Bank and Gaza are known as the occupied Palestinian territories. And since 1967, completely under Israeli dominance, either directly or indirectly. And the ICJ was asked to give a legal opinion. And for that, 52 countries and three international organizations made presentations on this question. Now, I think this was a very instructive set of hearings, and we have a report on it, of course. But I would also urge people to go to the site where the original presentations are recorded and take a look. Because on the one hand, it displays the clear global divide on this issue. A vast majority of countries calling out Israel's occupation and its various occupation tendencies. Now, when we talk about occupation, it's not just military occupation. We know about the impact of settlements, where over 700,000 illegal settlers have taken over large parts of Palestinian land. We know about the wall that separates their territories. We know about the innumerable checkpoints. We know about the blockade in Gaza, which has caused the kind of harm that cannot be calculated or qualified or quantified in any particular way because of its impact over the years, persisting for so many years. All of these are parts of the, part of the occupation, the kind of at every level, the impact on the people of Palestine, whether it be health, whether it be their freedom of expression, whether it be incarceration, all of this, so much of this is a consequence of occupation. And I think country after country very powerfully made the case and to various degrees called out these occupation. Of course, many of these countries called it directly apartheid. Some others did not. But again, making it clear that there are many countries which also believe the same. It's just a few years ago, there was not much talk about apartheid, although the Palestinians have always been saying it. And over time, we've had UN agencies, we've had NGOs, and now we also have so many countries which are, at least some of them are beginning to call it for what it is. On the other hand, we had a very, very small group of countries led by the United States, the United Kingdom, etc., which refused to go along with that argument, which kept insisting that the International Court of Justice not deliver a verdict on this issue. And they cited various reasons. Ironically, I believe it was the US which said that there should be a process of of consultation, of negotiation, the two-state solution, etc., etc., which especially now seems quite incredible, considering the fact, if you look at how US spokespersons have been responding, how, in complete denial, how the U.S. government's policies itself are the single largest reason for this war to continue. Many countries also called out the U.S. for that matter. But also for that matter, we had the U.K., which delivered a very similar argument, asking the ICJ not to, not to deliver a verdict without consulting Israel. So we had a very small set of countries, maybe five or six at the most, I think, which went in that direction. But a vast majority of these countries taking a very clear stand on this. And of course, it's going to take some more time for this verdict to come out on this. It's maybe 6 months after that goes to the UN General Assembly, where the UN General Assembly, as we know, has already been passing pro-Palestine resolutions for many years now. And of course, neither Israel nor its main backers, such as the US and the UK, have bothered to heed that at all. So, but nonetheless, the fact remains that if the ICJ does rule on these matters on the lines of what many of these countries have been arguing, it will be yet another setback for Israel. It will be yet another, highlighting the fact that the brutality of occupation is a day-to-day affair, that even if, for instance, say some kind of a ceasefire is reached at this point, the brutality of that occupation does not change at all. For instance, we do know that 10,000, and right now, the number of prisoners in Israeli jails has almost doubled. It's, I think, close to over 9,000, where it was around 5,000 earlier. And this itself kind of shows in the past few months kind of impact occupation is having. So keeping all this in mind, I think a very important case and a very important wording that we should see in a few months.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's important to suggest that, yes, these governments have taken a complaint to the International Court of Justice, which is an intergovernmental judicial body. So only governments can go there. But governments in many cases are also reflecting the mood, the temperature on the streets, mass rolling cycles of demonstrations in a large number of countries. Remarkably, in places like the United States, over 5,000 demonstrations across most of the cities and so on. Zoe, this cycle of protests seems to be continuing over and over again, and there's going to be a new cycle opening up, as we get towards Ramadan, when which will be a month of reflection and prayer for Muslim people. Now, all Palestinians are not Muslims, but a majority of Palestinians are Muslims. This is an important period we're entering into. Tell us about these new cycles of protest.
Well, on March 2nd, tomorrow, there is a global day of action already. There's 100 actions and street protests that are going to be taking place in over a dozen countries across the world. Major left and progressive formations like the International People's Assembly, Progressive International, La Via Campesina, the World March of Women in Latin America, the Trade Union Confederation of the Americas, many, many major left platforms that have been expressing their solidarity with Palestine and condemning Israel's genocide over the past several months are all coming together to have a huge day of mobilization, specifically because of the threats that Israel has made of the invasion of Rafah. We know that this is a region where there's about 1.5 million Palestinians. Over 1 million people had actually fled to Rafah because throughout the past several months, it was seen as the safe area. As Israel was demolishing the north, demolishing the center, they said, go to the south, go to the south, you'll be safe there. Again, a million people fled there, living in very precarious conditions, in tents, crowded into neighborhoods, into family homes. Essentially, Israel has said that they're going to invade. In February, they'd already announced they were going to invade, and immediately were met with a lot of backlash. They have still gone forward with issuing eviction orders, but many are saying, how could an invasion like this go forward? Where are people going to flee? There will never be conditions for the civilian population of 1.5 million to actually be safe in such an invasion. And this has really stoked this international response, which we've seen, which will, again, be this massive day of mobilization on the 2nd. But we've also seen that because of this brutality and because of the massacre that already took place in Rafah earlier in February, that many countries actually who have had a position of standing with Israel and allegedly Israel's right to self-defense, have even come out against this invasion of Rafah. We saw Josep Borrell, of course, the chief of foreign affairs for the EU, saying that he completely does not support an invasion of Rafah. We saw 26 out of 27 of the ministers in the EU, again, coming out against this invasion. Even Biden himself has been forced to say some conciliatory words, of course, for the US, saying that we need to ensure that civilians are protected is sort of empty and meaningless, given that they're providing the weapons which are killing civilians. But again, the West is really feeling the pressure on this, just based on the clear and objective brutality of what this kind of operation would mean. And so there's going to be a massive day of mobilization. Again, Cuba, Venezuela, United States, I think in the US alone, there's dozens and dozens of actions planned, over 200 organizations across all sectors, healthcare workers, tech workers, local immigrant organizations of all nationalities have really joined in this mass mobilization. Understanding that as Biden has forced himself even to say these declarations like, we're going to see a ceasefire by next week, which again, he has since retracted and saying that was hasty. But clearly the cracks are there, and people, these organizations are saying that it's necessary to keep pushing, keep mobilizing, because the West is isolated in their continued support of Israel. And the concessions that have been made, the concessions that Biden has had to make, you know, of course, again, kind of empty and meaningless, but still they have been brought out because of the pressure, because of the fact that everywhere he goes, he's called Genocide Joe, because he's met with protests everywhere, because all of his main political allies are also hounded everywhere they go. So it's going to be a huge day of mobilization. We're definitely going to see, again, very high levels of people being on the street.
That's a very important way to close down the first half of our show today. It's not just the violence, the bread massacre and so on, but people are on the streets, they are protesting. For that kind of arc of reporting from the bad side of history to the good side, that's the reason you come to give the people what they want. Brought to you from People's Dispatch, that's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter, really happy to have you with us. We're going to switch and go to the Sahel region, where there had been, since the last 3 years, upsurge in a political sense, some coup d'etats, which we've tried on this show to provide a political explanation for why have there been coups in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, the creation of the Federation, and why, Prashant, the regional grouping of ECOWAS initially decided to take such a strong position against the coups, now they backed off. Tell us, what is ECOWAS, what has it been doing in the Sahel, and what is the recent position from ECOWAS?
Right, Vijay. Of course, ECOWAS, a West African bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, as it is called, unfortunately has seen its reputation really suffer over the past few years because of the position it has taken, widely now seen as some kind of an enforcer for the agenda of imperialist countries such as the United States or even France for that matter. And quite unfortunate, because on this show we also talked about the potential of regional or other blocks of countries of the global south, their ability to maybe push back and fold, push their own agenda and craft their own agenda. But at this point, ECOWAS is definitely not one of those blocks which is doing that. And I think a critical point in this whole situation came when last year, there was a coup in Niger. The military took over, accusing President Mohamed Bazoum of being basically a proxy for the French. A coup which was actually widely supported. We have talked about this before as well. Coups in countries like Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger for that matter, which kind of transcend the traditional understanding of coups and actually are widely supported and possibly even have the potential to become anti-imperialist in character. And at this moment, what we saw was basically that ECOWAS, when confronted with such a moment, chose to enforce very, very harsh sanctions on Niger. For instance, Niger extremely dependent on its neighbor Nigeria for electricity, but all service transactions, including utility services, were sanctioned by ECOWAS. At a point when a massive, considerable amount of its budgets were being sanctioned through external loans and grants, there were again sanctions imposed. So ECOWAS imposed this wide variety of sanctions, which had a very, you know, serious impact on the people of Niger. We're talking about food price hikes, we talk about medicine shortages, all kinds of issues. And I think our correspondent Tarupriya basically has a good article which talks about both of these at this point. And but what happened was that these sanctions, ECOWAS also basically made noises in terms of wanting to declare war. At that point, somewhere after July last year, everyone was holding their breath to see if, you know, there would be an attack by ECOWAS. But ECOWAS kind of backed off because internally there was no real support within these countries, and there was a lot of opposition to that possibility. And in such a situation, ECOWAS kind of held back. Meanwhile, the three countries we talked about, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, together formed what is called the Alliance of Sahel States. And these countries recently, a few weeks ago, announced their withdrawal at least from ECOWAS, leaving the future of the bloc itself in considerable doubt. And it is in this situation that I think ECOWAS has really been sort of forced to pull back and withdraw many of these sanctions in place. Maybe it's an attempt to prevent these three countries from leaving, which would seriously dent the credibility of these bloc as a whole. These three countries have substantial landmass for that matter. And, you know, ECOWAS would be, even in terms of its size, ECOWAS would really kind of decline if these three countries left, not to mention that they're in the heart of the bloc. So I think ECOWAS right now, for instance, choosing to withdraw. But nonetheless, I think many important questions remain. And I think the countries that are part of the Alliance of Sahel States are very considering these issues, the fact that what enables ECOWAS to impose such sweeping sanctions, the kind of control it has, the kind of financial institutions that exist, the CFA franc, the banking infrastructure, all of which together give blocs such as ECOWAS a huge amount of power over individual countries. And along with ECOWAS, countries like France also have that kind of power. So I think the key question that the AES countries are right now examining is that, can they create these kind of alternatives? Can they sort of throw away the dependence on countries such as France? Can they develop their own infrastructure? Very difficult for these countries. They're not the richest countries in the world. They're not first world countries. But nonetheless, the fact that they are thinking about these things, they are thinking about sovereignty is not merely geographical or military, but also financial. Basically, it does mean that there is a very interesting experiment going on in the Sahel region. And that's why I think we've been time and again talking about this region.
That's the Sahel region in Africa. That's the region just below the Sahara, a very key place, was colonized by the French, now fighting to establish its sovereignty. We started the show talking about Palestine. In fact, we spent the first half of the show on Palestine. What doesn't get much coverage around the world is the horrible violence, the war imposed on the Great Lakes region of Africa. The center of this now is in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You see, what's been happening is that region has been contested between the Ugandan government, rebel groups from Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Over the last three decades, 10 million children have been killed in the Great Lakes region, with the focus again on North Kivu, the center being the capital city of Goma. You see, this conflict, which intensified in a way in March 2022, began a displacement of almost 2 million people from that region, many of them going towards refugee camps in cities like Goma, Sake, and others around the belt that goes from the Ugandan border down all the way south of Goma. There's been an enormous displacement of people in that region. This is in the Democratic Republic of Congo, one of the richest countries in the world when it comes to raw materials, at the same time, very poor when it comes to the well-being of the population. Between the 28th of January and the 12th of February, the violence has intensified. And the so-called rebel forces, I have some doubts about whether we call the M23 group a rebel group. It's more like a proxy force of the Rwandan government. Various other military forces from Uganda have been moving south very quickly along the Goma road towards Goma. There's been shelling in the outskirts of Goma. Residents inside Goma many of them refugees already, terrified about the loss of life that is impending. Now, to stop this, the South African army has come in to help the Democratic Republic of Congo. There have been troops from other Southern African countries. In fact, many of the heads of government met in Namibia recently to have a conversation about this. Military heads have met in Goma, in North Kivu, to talk about how they're going to defend this area against the advance. Very little coverage of this already. As I said, millions of people have been killed in this conflict over the past decades, and now it threatens hundreds of thousands of people's lives that are living in Goma. This is quantitatively a greater potential death toll than we're seeing in Gaza. Doesn't mean that it's a worse conflict. This is not a conflict Olympics. But I think it bears reflection that we need to cover this particular conflict with some care and try to explain to people what is happening. Over the next several weeks on this show, you can be guaranteed to get much more information about what's been happening in Eastern Congo, particularly North Kivu. For now, just to say, the forces advancing toward the city are at its outskirts. They have begun to shell neighborhoods where the refugees live. The South African forces have lost a couple of soldiers. They are going to try to defend that city. This is going to be an enormous battle. Right now, we are just waiting and watching, not sure what's going to happen. But we'll come back to this with a great deal of focus, I know. Zoe, we're going to close out the show. You're going to tell us a little bit about Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, the latest things going on in his last months of the presidency before there's an election in Mexico. What's been happening with the man known as AMLO?
Well, it's been an interesting kind of week and a half in Mexico. And a familiar suspect in these sort of developments, the New York Times, has played a key role in really what's been happening in Mexico. The New York Times came out with a report last week, which I think was titled something like U.S. government investigates possible drug ties with AMLO, with Mexico's president. So the title, of course, kind of vague, kind of confusing. The body of the article itself, even more confusing, because it essentially says that at one point, the Drug Enforcement Agency of the United States investigated whether or not Andrés Manuel López Obrador had links to cartels and had received some sort of amount of campaign financing in his 2006 campaign. But the article itself, I think the second paragraph, states that there was not enough evidence. The DEA concluded that it was an inconclusive investigation. There wasn't enough evidence, and that these allegations could not be brought forward. There could be no formal investigation because the evidence just wasn't there. And so the New York Times publishes this story, again, really making these broad accusations, but also having to walk it back in the same sentence. And this, of course, was met with a lot of, when the article was published, it was immediately rejected and immediately sort of criticized by broad sections of the Mexican progressive movements. Andrés Manuel, on his daily press conference, the Mañanera, that same day, spoke at length about this article and called it completely baseless, completely false. And he actually read out the exchange that was received by his media spokesperson, Jesus Ramirez. And he essentially says, you know, this reporter from the New York Times sends me essentially an interrogation list of questions, which, you know, essentially says, how much have you been working with the cartels? How much did they, you know, these cornering questions. We've talked a lot about how the New York Times is essentially a State Department stenographer. And once again, we're seeing that. And so Andres Manuel reads out this exchange. And for anyone who's watched the Mañanera, you know, he has this very jovial tone. He makes jokes. He says, like, look at this. Isn't this ridiculous? He shows the entire email. It includes the phone number of the journalist because she says, you know, get back to me with this deadline at this time with your responses. And here's my number. he puts this up in his press conference and he says, I'm going to respond now. And he responds to each one of the questions saying, this is ridiculous. There's, again, evidence to show that this isn't true, et cetera, et cetera. The New York Times immediately publishes a statement condemning Andres Manuel once again, essentially, and saying that he, you know, put in violation this reporter and her phone number, et cetera, et cetera. YouTube actually took down the video of Andres Manuel responding to these accusations. But I think really what this sort of back and forth really shows is just, you know, what lengths these sort of media projects, these media outlets will go to be complicit in campaigns to kind of destabilize, cast accusations, cast doubt. Again, Andres Manuel is a president who has an over 70% approval rating. He's not perfect. It's not saying that he's done, nothing can be criticized, but he is someone who's widely popular because of policies to make Mexico sovereign in terms of their energy, raising the minimum wage, creating better conditions for the working class. So now that there's these elections coming up, June 2024, Claudia Sheinbaum is the chosen successor, extremely popular as well. We can see that this campaign against Andres Manuel is not random. There have been two other media reports essentially saying similar things. There was an investigation by the DEA. It didn't go forward. So why are they writing reports on things that are essentially baseless if there's no political intention, which is essentially what progressives are saying? There was a mobilization outside the New York Times. Again, not in this sense, not it wasn't a one of the Palestine mobilizations, which have been every single week in front of the New York Times because of their, you know, extremely biased reporting in favor of Israel. Mexican community mobilizing and saying, hands off Andres Manuel, no more media slander, no more destabilization campaigns. And this is definitely going to be something that continues until the elections in June 2024. Again, Mexican right using a lot of tools in the book to try to gain this upper hand against, again, a very, very popular mandate.
Well, that's give the people what they want. We've come to you starting with the bread massacre. Please follow that story. We'll come back to it next week. Give the people what they want, brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. See you next week. We shall overcome.